Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Trish, can I share with you a little thing that happened in an exercise class I went to this week, which fascinated me and gave it gave me the giggles, and it also gave me quite a lot of joy, actually.
It wasn't unpleasant sounds or smells, was it?
No.
Okay.
Nothing like that. Little Pilates class, pop along quietly, and the trainer
instructor. Yes.
At the beginning, the instructor says, has anybody got any injuries I should know of? Mm-hmm. Let me know now and I can help you out. And this lady came up to her in front of the whole class and she said, I don't want to put my arms up in the air. I don't want to put my arms down low. And I don't really want to break out into too much of a sweat.
Oh.
And I was just struck by the idea that you could say at the beginning of an exercise class, these are the things I do not want to do. I would like to leave halfway through, and I'd like to take a phone call, if I may. I mean, it just opened up a whole world of just asking for what you want. I thought, how fabulous.
It's just a bit of bespoke gone mad, isn't it? Bespoke class gone mad. And how did this poor instructor respond? Did she manage to keep a straight face?
She did keep a straight face. Mm. I was rather impressed. And she was very understanding. She said, is it because of an injury? And the lady said, no. I wanted to put my hand up and say, I can't do the splits. Is that okay? I want to be able to do the splits by the end of this class.
Was it just all core work then, with no hands in the air, like we don't care? Or did she just ignore her?
You know what? Pilates is very slow, Trish, very slow. Yeah. And there is no breaking out in a sweat in Pilates,
for God's sake. Take responsibility for yourself, you know? Don't inflict it on everybody else.
But imagine being able to ask for what you want in such a forthright manner in front of a whole class of people. I think that's brilliant.
You see, that's the difference between you and me.
It is.
Hello, welcome to Postcards from Midlife. I'm Lorraine Candy.
I'm Trish Halpin, and we're on a mission to help you make the most of your magnificent midlife. We'll be tackling everything from mind and body wellness to HRT and your sex drive. Lorraine and I are here to help you have a stylish second act and answer all your midlife questions on fashion, beauty, careers, relationships, family, and as always, the challenges and joys of parenting teens.
Now, before we kick off the show today, Trish, I'm going to ask you how your exams are going.
Yes, they might as well be.
Yes, mine are a little stressful, frankly. Mm-hmm. My eldest is doing exams at uni, and my 18-year-old has started her A-levels. The house is full of what I call tension, as opposed to tension. I made a cup of tea yesterday, and it was the wrong colour, and there was some kind of Hulk-like response to it. And I've mostly been hiding in the car in the garden this week.
That's probably sensible tactics. Yes, we've gone into don't speak to me mode. We've got a bit of don't ask me, don't tell me anything. So, of course, I've got a pair of them both doing their A-levels.
Twin A-levels.
Thankfully, one of them's done two course-based subjects, so they only have one set. But the other one was very much don't look at me when I come back, don't speak to me, don't ask me. But actually, it came back incredibly jolly because it'd gone well. But we've just been focusing on being incredibly prepared, or as in making sure they've got the travel card the night before, because one of those got lost last week and it was a disaster.
Yeah.
So disaster prevention, I would say, mainly, and not speaking. But I suppose we just have to be patient really until it's all over, because apparently there are going to be 700,000 A-levels awarded this year. So it's good to know we're not alone as we navigate this part of the parenting journey.
Well, I have been through it once before with the A-levels, mm-hmm. and I think sort of being patient, yes, is the only way. You have to sort of hold your tongue and tread carefully. I've got to go through it twice more, Trish. So by the time my 11-year-old gets to her exams, I'm going to be like Buddha. I'm going to be that patient.
You are. That's in about 7 years. But I kind of was thinking you might be more like Yoda in your wiseness and slightly small and shriveled, do you think? A bit green.
Raisin-like.
Yes.
Thanks for that, Trish. I did talk to quite a few adolescent mental health experts when I was writing the book on parenting teens, and they said the key, should anyone want to know, is to be well, just to be there and to be as unobtrusive as possible unless they ask you. And that's kind of ninja parenting. There is a new book out, Dr. Tara Porter's book called You Don't Know Me, which is pretty good on how to help teens relax around their grades and, you know, to help them avoid this kind of achievement mindset. And also one of mine is using something called the Flora app, which is really sweet. So it's an app that you revise with and then blocks out everything else so you don't get any notifications. But every time you achieve a certain goal, you plant a little flower in your garden and you do it with all your friends and then you compare gardens. And then every morning I'll say to her, how's your garden looking today? So this is a little touch point that we have. Obviously, if you asked her to go into the actual garden, she'd batter me with a calculator, but she likes this little revision game. Just don't remember it being this stressful.
It's very different for us. I mean, I think about, I think because my parents weren't really that involved at all, just weren't, we just got on with it, did we? We just not interested. I was given over the dining room to do my revision and spread out my books, because obviously back in those days, you probably lived in a house, we had a very small kitchen, you had a little dining room. And I have to say, the whenever I see a kind of lacy tablecloth now, I have Hamlet quotes going through my head. I just can't help myself. But yeah, I think it was different. I was talking to Neil about this, actually. We didn't even have the pressure within the schools to do that well. It was just, I think my school wasn't a kind of university feeder school. So it was kind of, I don't know, what about yours? Probably was similar, I expect.
It was a comprehensive. It had really the next step was you went to work, basically. That was the next step. And I was advised by my careers teacher that I'd probably be quite good working in an old people's home, given my lack of academic. I mean, there would be sort of pandemic levels of death in old people's home if I was working in. I'd be absolutely useless at it.
How your life could have turned out if you'd worked in an old people's home.
Which would different. Be, I'm sure some people would be brilliant at it, but it would not be something I would have been brilliant at.
No, exactly. Well, I'm sure we will look back on all of this with humour and discuss it over Christmas lunch with our grandchildren one of these days when we're small and Yoda-like.
I do love the thought of grandchildren, Trish, because you know I'm baby mad, absolutely baby mad. I can't wait. In fact, our show today is very family orientated, isn't it?
Yes, it is, because we have a really fascinating guest. Miriam Taves is an award-winning Canadian author whose novels revolve around families, in fact, and how they interact. She's got quite an exceptional personal story to tell, and I think listeners will learn a lot about family relationships and in particular how trauma affects families.
Yes, I was really excited when she said yes to coming on the show, because her life has been really different from anyone else we've ever had on the podcast, actually. She's in her 50s. She lives with her mum, her daughter, her son-in-law and her grandchildren and her partner. And she grew up in the religious group, the Mennonites, which she ran away from when she was 18. There's been a lot of loss and heartbreak in her family, but her books are seriously funny. I mean, I can't imagine being able to live through all that she has lived through and write. Well, they're laugh out loud novels.
They really are. And it's such a privilege, isn't it, that we get to interview wonderful women like these on the podcast. And I hope all of you listeners will be able to take something away from the show today, which will be helpful for you.
Being helpful is what we're here for, isn't it, Trish? And on that note, can I draw your attention to our private Facebook group list of mid-morning snacks? Have you seen this?
Yes, I did see that.
I'm very excited about it, because you know I like a Cadbury fruit and nut and an after eight mint, which of course
and a hobnob.
Yeah, they're just not very good for you, are they? What's your favorite snack?
I'm going to be really controversial, you know what I'm going to say.
Apple or something.
I don't snack. I'm not a snacker.
Silly.
Well, with a dark chocolate in the afternoon, but no snacks for me.
You're an anomaly. Anyway, I'm going to direct everyone to that thread if you're in the market for a new snack. I particularly liked the blackberries and cream. It's quite a good snack, isn't it?
Blackberries and cream? That's pudding. That's pudding to you. Yes.
And obviously the main theme is if you eat proper breakfast, eggs and the like, we'll all be like you, Trish. We won't snack.
No, no snacking, no snacking distraction. But enough snack chat, in fact. It's time to get on with the show. We're going to be kicking off Postcards from Midlife with a Cult Club book special, because it's all about books today.
Today, we have got three books each for our Culture Club book special that we're going to recommend, and they roughly fit into sort of three categories: a novel for your summer holiday, a book for your midlife mindset, and a book that may make a good gift or tweak your thinking in some way. So I'm going to kick off with a giant name drop, Fish, because I know
surprise,
you have
missed surprise.
My name drops. Let me get the book in front
of
me.
We've had a few this series already. Off you go.
Here I go. This book is Go Gently by Bonnie Wright. Do you remember Ginny Weasley, in Harry Potter? And may I just mention, I know the lovely Bonnie because very oddly, when I used to edit Elle, we used to have something called the Run Club, and we used to do a lot of small, short 5K, 10K runs. And this lovely couple came up to me at one of our runs in Victoria Park and said, could our daughter run with you? Because she's sort of here on her own and she's just started running. She'd like to run, and she's a big fan of Elle. She's a big reader. And they brought Ginny Weasley over to run with
Ginny
us.
Ginny Weasley. Was she Ginny Weasley at the time? Of course she was.
No, I think she'd finished. Obviously finished. Oh, this must have been about 5 years ago.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
So she's went to LA, and she's written this really lovely book, and it's Actionable Steps to Nurture Yourself and the Planet. And what I like about it, and I like the title, Go Gently, is that it's really simple things, and it's all about, you know, because you can get so overwhelmed with climate change and everything that's happening. And I think it's nice to read what a young person, much younger person, is thinking and who they're looking to for advice. And also this idea that just do the bits that you can do that affect you, that you're passionate about and that matter to you. So it is kind of recipes. It's how to make your home a little bit more eco-friendly, and you what to read and where to read. And it really kind of opened my eyes to new names, because I think if we're of our age, we keep looking to the same experts, and we're a bit of a bubble, an echo chamber. And it's all about little small steps, and it's really beautifully produced, so I thought that would be a nice present. Go Gently by Bonnie Wright.
The credentials here, is this what she does now? Is this her thing?
Yes, she works with Greenpeace. So
amazing.
She's really absolutely immersed. And that was the other thing I really liked, is that she what Bonnie's gone off and done is really properly immersed herself in this, and she's kind of used her fame, because they are so famous, aren't they, the Harry Potter cast? And she's used her fame to provide a toolkit, which is really helpful for her generation and other generations around her. And I thought it was a really impressive thing to do, actually.
Excellent, excellent. So my Tweak Your Thinking, if that's where we are, is called Wired for Love, A Neuroscientist's Journey Through Romance, Loss, and the Essence of Human Connection, which is a bit of a mouthful. It's by Stephanie Cacioppo, and she's a psychiatrist and behavioral neuroscientist at the University of Chicago. But it's essentially a love story, and it's kind of the story of her science and the research, and then the science behind her story, her love story. So she was actually 36 and publishing papers on romantic love and all of this kind of thing. But she'd never been in love herself, and she just assumed it was never going to happen to her. It was too late. But then she goes off to some academic conference and meets this guy called John, who is an academic and an expert on the dangers of loneliness to physical and mental well-being. And hey ho, they get together and become this incredible pair and have this amazing love story. They have a spur of the moment wedding in Paris, and then she starts writing a column called Modern Love in the New York Times. So it was really zeitgeisty. And then it isn't a spoiler, because it's very much part of the story from the start. He dies of cancer in 2018. But she just has so many fascinating insights about love from the brain's perspective, and how love can stay with us, love and loss and grief, and just how important it is to kind of our cognitive and biological kind of necessities. So I thought that was really interesting. There's also quite a lot in there about the snobbery and sexism she experienced in wanting to study what was seen as a kind of really soft subject, but actually is this kind of, you know, acute biological need. Yes. And she concludes that love is the opposite of loneliness. So him and his loneliness and her love together. And yeah, it was really a really good book. I would recommend that one. What about you? A bit of a summary. Take me away somewhere.
Well, I'm going to take you away with one of the shortlisted books from the Women's Prize of Fiction, which we've talked about because I'm judging, and we're going to announce the winner of the Women's Prize in 2 weeks' time, June the 13th, I think it is. So Elif Shafak, The Island of Missing Trees. I know you're a fan of Elif's writing. I think it's just the loveliest summer read. It was shortlisted for the Costa Novel Award as well. It's about two teenagers, a Greek Cypriot, Turkish Cypriot. They meet in a taverna on the island they both call home. And then it's really the story of their life when they're separated. And she comes to London with her parents, and there's a little bit of tragedy, but it's all witnessed by the fig tree And part of the story, I'd say a third of the story, is told by the fig tree. And it also tells the story of the insects around the fig tree. It's really, it's one of the most extraordinary books I've ever read, because it's such a different way of writing a book. It's historical as well, because it's about the war. Mm. It's about teenage love. And lasting love. It's about a young woman growing up in London. It's about secrets and silence. It's just really lovely. It's one of those that you'd start sort of on the plane on your holiday, and then you would be desperate to get to it on your sun lounger.
Oh, I'm definitely putting that on my list then. So I'm taking you away, not abroad, but back in time, because you know I love my historical novels and dramas and fiction. And this one is set in the early 1900s in England, and it's called The Dictionary of Lost Words by Pip Williams, who's actually an Australian writer, but it's very much an English-based book. And it tells the story of these people who were compiling the Oxford English Dictionary. And it's told through this character called Esme, which is my daughter's name, and she's the daughter of one of the men working on it, and it's kind of about her interactions with the characters based on the real people behind the book. But basically she collects words that fall off this table. Like, they write all these words on scraps of paper and then they discard some, and she kind of collects them. These are words that are in use in the English language in society at this time, but they kind of get disregarded, and then she writes her own manuscript, because a lot of them, of course, they're women's words to do with women and associated with women discarded.
Who wants women's time? Words?
It's very much a kind of an exploration about, do words mean different things to men and women? And then there's, you know, she gets involved with the suffragettes. So there's a lot of interesting stuff in there, which I really liked. And I thought I'd just point out to you that, you know, you were mentioning about the fact that men don't read books written by women, or
they don't.
Not enough. There was also, I read a thing recently that there are, and it's all done through AI at this university in America, there are four times as many male characters in literature than female characters, would you believe? And it's part of this study called the Gutenberg Project. And they was also able to analyze words associated with these female characters. And of course, they were, you know, coming up with things like weak, amiable, and pretty. And of course, the words associated with men, you can guess, were things like leadership, power, strength.
Do you say these things just to make me angry, Trish, with the patriarchy again?
Yes, Crosser. That's true. But anyway, I thought that was interesting. And I like the idea of the Dictionary of Lost Words bringing things back round to where they should be.
Good.
With these words. Right.
My final book for you. Mm-hmm. It's our midlife recommendation, and it's out on June the 16th. Now, do you remember we had Christy Watson on the show?
Lovely Christy.
We had her on in November, didn't we, 2020? I thought it was last year, but it's actually the year before. So Christy is a nurse, and she's written two best-selling books about nursing, really about nursing
memoirs,
they were dying as well. They're quite extraordinary books. And she came on and talked about that and what she'd learned from that. But she has now written, she's in her late 40s, Quilt on Fire, The Messy Magic of Midlife, which is her very personal memoir. So she's a single mum. So it's about being a single mum, dating, having her teenage daughter living at home. And what I liked about it, there's a really brilliant line, the exhilaration of being a middle-aged woman with a wild heart. She got a really wild heart, Christy Watson. She's very entertaining. It's kind of laugh out loud funny. It starts with her being really hungover, and it just talks its way through all the things she encounters while at the same time, because obviously she went back into nursing, but while at the same time being perimenopausal.
Oh, yes.
So it really is a book where if you think you are going through all of this alone, that the brain fog is entirely, you know, brain tumour, as I thought mine was, this book will make you feel less alone, and it will also make you laugh out
loud. That's what we need.
Yeah.
That's
and I'm interviewing her actually for Fame Productions for the book when it comes out. And I think recording goes live after June the 16th, so you'll be able to watch it.
Amazing. Good for you. That's a good one. Right. Now, my midlife mindset, it's not necessarily an easy read, but I think it's a really important one and a timely one. And it's called Nonfiction by Julie Myerson. And I'm sure most of our listeners will be familiar with Julie. And I just remember, you know, when I became an editor many, many years ago, she was the writer that you wanted to get writing for you. She wrote these incredible books. And, you know, she was always one of these women that you just thought she's so talented. She's got this gorgeous family. You just think that she's leading a charmed life. But that obviously wasn't to be the case. And the theme of this book is actually about teenage drug addiction. And this is obviously something Julie went through herself. In 2009, she wrote about her eldest son, Jake's increasingly heavy use of skunk marijuana and the decision she and her husband took to kick him out of the family home. And there was a big furore, wasn't there? And actually,
well, he sold his story, didn't he, I think, to the papers. It was really sad to hear all of that.
It was very sad. And we don't know what's happened since then, because she wrote a book about that experience, again, fictionalized in 2016, but we haven't heard from her since. And so this is fictional, but based on these themes. And it's about a mother and a daughter, and the daughter who has a drug addiction. And I think given what we know about what girls are suffering at the moment, particularly
crisis of mental health,
then the our people. Kind of how we feel about ourselves as our capability as mothers, all of that is in there. So it's not going to be an easy read, but it's a beautiful read and probably a very important read.
So thank you everyone for listening to our book themed culture club. We're going to put all the books that we recommend on our Facebook page. Be great to know what you're all reading, listeners, as well. You can comment on the Facebook post, or you can email us your thoughts at hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
For this week's book club episode, our special guest is the best-selling Canadian writer Miriam Taves, whose award-winning novels include A Complicated Kindness, All My Puny Sorrows, and Women Talking, which is currently being made into a film starring Rooney Mara, Frances McDormand, and Claire Foy. Miriam's narratives are frequently framed by her experiences being brought up in a Mennonite community and centre on the perspectives of strong women who have suffered much but are determined to persevere. Her new novel, Fight Night, takes the form of a nine-year-old's letter to her absent father detailing her home life, where she lives with her irrepressible grandmother, Elvira, and her pregnant mother, Mushi, who struggles with mental health issues. Welcome to Postcards from Midlife, Miriam.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So you're joining us, we can see, from your home in Toronto. And we are fascinated by this idea that you live with your partner, your mother, your daughter, your grandchildren. I mean, for most of us, I have to be honest, the idea of living with it extended family would not be ideal. How do you make it work?
Well, it kind of came about out of necessity. So my partner and I are in this laneway house that we just had built here, this tiny little house, which I'm in right now. And just, on the same property is the larger house. And my mother is on the main floor where she has been for the last 10 years. And then my daughter and her partner and two kids are on the second floor, sort of squished on the second floor. Oh, wow. And it's been fantastic. You know, we can all care for each other. My mother, who has health issues, it's just really great that you know, my daughter and her family are there to help. I can babysit. But I think what's really important is just having sort of, you know, established boundaries. And we all have our own space.
Your mum's 90, isn't she?
No, she's only 86.
Oh, she's 86. Well, that's pretty amazing anyway. How does it work on a day-to-day basis then? I'm absolutely fascinated because I'm struggling living with the three teenagers and a 10-year-old at the moment. So do you have meals together? And how does it work?
I hear you. We do off and on. So my mother has dinner sometimes with my daughter. And then on three or four nights a week, she'll come here and have dinner with Eric and I. Georgia, my daughter, does most of the grocery shopping for my mother as she's doing.
Sounds idyllic.
It is. It really is. Two of my grandchildren are here, my daughter's kids, and they're three, almost four, and one, almost four, mm. almost one. And so, you know, they can just sort of like toddle back and forth, you
That's
know.
Adorable. Yeah. So we're here to talk about Fight Night, your latest book, which is about intergenerational living and you know, a lot of stories of women and women's lives. Really also part of your story for British listeners who may not know the huge background to where you're from is growing up in the Mennonite community. Just for our listeners, can you explain what a Mennonite community is? Because it's not something that we come across very often here.
There are different types of Mennonite communities. And so I grew up in a conservative Mennonite community, the first Mennonite settlements, or at least one of the first here in Canada. You know, there are different ways of being Mennonite. There's a Mennonite community here in Toronto. My mother is a member of a Mennonite church here, which is a liberal, open-minded Mennonite church, unlike the type of Mennonite church that she attended, that I attended as a kid in our hometown, which was very conservative, fundamentalist. So the Mennonites are basically a group that were formed under the leadership of Menno Simons, a guy in the 1500s in Holland, kind of broke away from the Catholic Church to do their own thing, you know, all over the world. And so there are very, very ultra-conservative Mennonite communities that are remote, that are isolated, that I've written about in other books, often in South America and Central America, places like that. And then there are, I guess, more urban, more modern Mennonite communities all over the world.
It's a very patriarchal society, though, when you say conservative.
Traditionally, absolutely, yes.
How does it influence Fight Night, your latest book? What is, where do we see it in that novel?
So the characters, particularly Grandma and Mushi, Swiv's mom, grew up in a very traditional conservative Mennonite community, as I did. And they're sort of fighting that as they do all of their lives, the impact of that, the effects of that. And particularly in the book, at least, there's a Mennonite elder pastor from the community who continues to sort of harass them, essentially, you know, trying to get them to come back into the fold, renounce their modern secular lives. So they make a lot of jokes about this guy. And Swiv sort of sees all of this. She's grown up differently in the city.
I mean, it's hard not to fall in love with these three women. We have grandmother Elvira Swiv, as you mentioned, the nine-year-old, and you know, you feel this enormous empathy for Mushi, the pregnant mother, as well. Can you just tell our listeners a little bit about each of them before you read us a little extract, please?
Yeah, well, Grandma definitely, I think, is the central character. Swiv's the narrator. She's 9 years old, and she is writing basically about her life. She's writing to her father, who's gone, he's disappeared, he's taken off. And she's writing about her life with her mother and with her grandmother. So Grandma is, you know, feisty, the matriarch, independent, outspoken, and is attempting to homeschool Swiv. Swiv's been kicked out of school for fighting. So Grandma and Swiv spend an awful lot of time together, teaching each other in a way. And Grandma being acutely aware of Swiv's anxiety. She's an anxious kid. You know, there's a lot of stuff. There's a lot of tough stuff going on in her life. Mushi is the mother. She is an actress. She's always gone. She's mostly gone. She's at rehearsals. She's also anxious. She's suffering, you could say, from a type of mental illness or anxiety, depression, whatever it is, but still, you know, trying to keep things together, trying to work, trying to make a living, take care of her older mother. And again, Swiv is observing and documenting it.
The extract that we thought it would be lovely for you to read comes quite early on in the book, and it's basically a kind of a description of, you get their personalities, but also some of the domestic arrangements that go on in this way of living, which we thought would be nice to hear from you.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. So this is just sort of the beginning of the book. Swiv is describing the situation. Grandma likes to tell Mom we've accomplished household tasks every day because Mom is having a complete nervous breakdown and a geriatric pregnancy, which doesn't mean she's going to push an old geezer out of her vag. It means she's too old to be up the stump and is so exhausted. And when she comes home from rehearsal, she's all, God, what a mess. God, you guys, what a dump. You can't pour fat down the drain. These pipes are ancient. You can't overload the toilet with toilet paper. Why are there conchiglietti's everywhere? Can't you two pick up a dish or put the shit away? Or have you ever even heard of household tasks? Mom's latest domestic freakout is that she always has to put all the food that's in the fridge at the very outer edges of the rack so that it's entirely visible to Grandma. Otherwise, Grandma thinks there's no food because she can't see it. And she doesn't move things around to see the food in the back of the fridge. And then she orders takeout or just eats ice cream or bacon or handfuls of cereal from the box. So now Mom lines everything up in a row on the outer edges of the fridge racks with labels like, this is lentil. eat it. This is kale salad. Eat it. Grandma doesn't eat anything green. Not a single thing, ever. It's like Samson in his hair. He can't cut it or he'll lose his strength. Grandma can't eat green things. She can detect green things in her food when Mom tries to hide them in there. I'm not going to spend my last 5 minutes on earth eating rabbit food.
It's so well done. It's such a lovely read, but it's such a funny read. But a lot of it tackles, as your books do, some really heavy, weighty subjects, some quite distressing moments in people's lives. There is the suicide of Elvira's other daughter. There is a lot of tragedy and loss in this book. And you've been through that yourself, for our listeners to know, through the depression and suicide of your father and your sister. I'm intrigued to know if writing helps with that, or whether it's cathartic, or whether it's actually really painful, and what we can learn from that.
I think all of those things. I mean, it's a type of pain. The pain, you know, from the grief, the loss, the tragedy is something that, and I'm sure you know, and people listening to this know, that it doesn't ever, you know, go away. There's no such thing as closure. You just sort of carry it. And as you get older, you know, you're carrying more and more of it, along with all the other things as well. So I think the writing is just a way of shaping up from that, of making sense of it, controlling it in a sense, owning it, and trying to make something artful, something that resonates, something that will connect me to other people. So taking it and you know, trying to make that connection. So for that reason, it is cathartic. On the other hand, there's always something more, you know, there's always another angle. There's always something, just as soon as I've finished writing a book and I've, you know, and I feel like, okay, you know, I've managed to wrestle some of this stuff onto the page and I've created this thing where I can put some of my own pain, you know, anxiety into, as soon as you're finished, the ink has barely dried and it's there again. So I think compulsion to write, I have to keep writing, you know.
Pain, and then there's also with Swiv, who obviously is 9, she certainly seems very wise beyond her years, but she's living in the shadow of her mother's mental health issues and the potential loss of her beloved ailing grandmother, which is a huge amount for a child to deal with. But we know, certainly here in the UK, you know, children are living with increasing amounts of mental illnesses within their family, especially since the pandemic, or, mm-hmm. you know, living with a parent who has issues. It's increasingly common. And what do you think that listeners could learn from how mm-hmm. Swiv is helped through this by mm-hmm. her mom and her grandma?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, that's so true. I think that talking about it, more people are talking about mental mm-hmm. illness and the realities of it. There's less reluctance to talk about it, to get help. But the system itself is still almost impenetrable in terms of mm-hmm. of accessing that help. You know, I think people are talking about it. The people suffering from it are talking about it. Families are talking about it. We're talking about how it's affecting us. But to have a support group, especially like you say, for kids who are basically responsible, kids, teenagers who are suffering themselves possibly, and then having to, you know, take care of, in a sense, like Swiv, you know, take care of other generations, or at least be living with them and observing it all. If it's a subject that is swept under the rug and not addressed, then these kids will obviously feel possibly ashamed. Oh, you know, my mom's crazy, or mm-hmm. I'm crazy, or I feel depressed, or I feel suicidal. All of these things that seem impossible to say out loud.
Have you talked about the mental illness in your family with your children? How did you bring that into the family conversation? Because there is a huge body of thinking in psychology, isn't there, that we pass pain and trauma mm-hmm. through families. And unless you deal with it or talk mm-hmm. about it out loud, it just becomes an imprint on the next generation. Have you been open mm-hmm. and honest about it, given what happened to your sister and your dad?
I feel so, yes, absolutely. And it is, I mean, you're right. You know, it is something that I think is inherited, and it's terrifying. Yeah. You know, for those of us who have experienced this with, you know, ourselves or our loved ones, constantly on guard, constantly looking for those, or even seeing them, imagining them, you know, those symptoms, those signs, you know, are you okay? What's going on? Is this just a bad mood, or is this just a low day? Are you just blue? You know, mm-hmm. are you just feeling, yeah. is this the beginning of something else? I think, you know, all of those things are, it becomes a big deal. And so bells go off and you start thinking, oh no, you know, this is going to end badly. And I think it's really, really important to talk about it for me, with my kids, with my mother, and eventually with my grandchildren. We can know the difference between a hard day and clinical depression, yeah. for, you know, mm-hmm. for instance, you know, on the other hand too, I mean, there is, because the fear is so real and we understand that this can happen, you know, you can become very depressed and you can kill yourself. This has happened in our family and it's happened several times. So I think that then also the tendency is to maybe not talk about it because it's such a
big subject.
So it's sort of like there's this profound need to talk about it and to constantly sort of be aware of it and to touch base with each other, you know. And then on the other hand, there's a tendency to push it away.
You are using humor really well around it as well. Is that one of the things you found that kind of, I mean, some of the books are very, some of the lines are very laugh out loud funny, but actually very sad as well. Is that something, something that you found is a really good tool in this circumstances?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I guess that's the use of humor is something that I've always written that way in a sense, more or less. It's a survival tool. It's a, you know, mechanism and armor in a sense, you know. I think with Swiv in Fight Night, you can very easily see right through that her humor often is a form of bravado, you know, a way to strengthen herself and keep herself going. And she also sees that tradition set too by her grandmother, by her mother, to a certain extent.
Now, despite the tragedy that Elvira has experienced and the hard knocks, she has this incredible zest for life. She laughs out loud. She's enthralled with adventure right through into her 80s. Can we assume that you have a really positive outlook on aging?
You know, in all honesty, I would like to say yes, I would. And I think to a certain degree, I do have a positive outlook. Certainly Elvira has a positive outlook. I don't know anybody who is more life-loving, more resilient, more, you know, embracing and with connection, human connection. I mean, that's who she is. And, you know, I'm also my father's daughter. And so, you know, my mother is certainly, you know, my role model. Absolutely.
Because her name is Elvira, we should point out. Her name is Elvira.
Yeah,
so there's no coincidence going
there's
on
no,
here.
There's no coincidence. And I had wanted to write about her. I'm getting there. I'm learning a lot from her. I'm happy that I'm getting older.
So you're in your 50s now. Tell us about your 40s. My 40s, Trish's 40s, a bit of a shock for us.
Yeah.
The perimenopause was a bit of a shock for us. We're just so Absolutely. Much we didn't know about. How were your 40s and how were your 50s?
You know, my husband and I divorced in my 40s. That was painful and prolonged and horrible for everybody. That was very, very difficult. After the divorce, I moved with my daughter from Winnipeg to Toronto. My sister died. My sister killed herself. And my mother then moved. That's, you know, when I said we're all living together out of necessity, we realized, you know, we really do need to be together, really circle of wagons at this point. And she moved to Toronto to be with me. And so it was just huge life changes. Yeah. And then in addition, menopause and work, my career or whatever you want to call it, our so-called career, you know, there seemed to be so many other more pressing things going on. My 40s was a time of great upheaval. Also of questioning myself, of being, you know, anxious about my place in the, like who I was, you know, strangely enough, even though, I mean, that seems to be the domain of adolescence. And yet there I was in my 40s thinking, you know, who am I? What am I doing? What do I need to do with my life? And that has changed now in my 50s and maybe just recently. I feel a sense of calm. I don't have burning questions. I don't have anymore. I'm sure that I haven't figured out. I haven't come up with answers to the questions or anything like that. They're just not pressing in on my brain anymore. So I think I'm a calmer person. I understand that I'm trying to be here for my family and to help and to love properly and to care for and to spend time with my grandchildren. And that seems to me right now in my life to be really enough. If I have a little bit of time to do my, you know, my writing, that's also
on the side. Yeah. And we got a lot of listeners in Canada, actually. What is the attitude to menopause and perimenopause? So in this country in the last year, well, maybe 18 months, it's suddenly become talked about. There've been two big TV documentaries about it. There've been about four books out. And the word perimenopause hadn't even been heard until about 18 months ago. So there's a kind of groundswell of women's voices at the moment here. Is it the same in Canada, do you think, or not?
I'm not sure about that. Certainly, I mean, my friends and I, friends of mine who are the same age, I mean, we talk about it. We talk about what we're going through, what we're experiencing, similar to mental illness, you know, and the subject of, yeah. of suicide, for instance. I mean, it's not as grave, but it is a subject that affects us. And men, you know, and women here in Canada are becoming a little bit more open to it, understanding that, oh, this is a real thing that women go through, you know, and it's not easy.
Well, the peak age for suicide in the UK is 45 to 49. So there is a direct correlation, they think, between, because obviously lack of estrogen causes all sorts of changes in the brain. So yeah, it's all beginning to be talked about a little bit, isn't it?
And that's fascinating too, you know, and the hormonal changes too, and chemistry and all of that. And reading a lot about suicide, as I do, I think often menopause, and we joke about it a lot, don't we? You know,
to our detriment.
Because certainly, I mean, having gone through it and continuing to, it changes you. It's not always easy.
We should talk about your 2018 book, Women Talking, because it's currently in production in Hollywood. I mean, what a stellar cast. We mentioned some of them in our introduction to you, Miriam, but we forgot to mention two Brits, Jessie Buckley and Ben Whishaw as well. Yeah, I mean, how amazing. But it is based on a very harrowing true story, isn't it, within a Mennonite colony in Bolivia. Can you just tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, the book Women Talking is an imagined response to these attacks, these rapes that occurred starting, I think, 2005 to 2009, 2011. The reality is that these types of attacks are not necessarily specifically these types of attacks, but, you know, rape and domestic violence and assaults have been going on forever and continue to within these ultra-conservative, isolated, fundamentalist, self-policed colonies, these communities. And so, and the women who, this is a Mennonite colony, are waking up at realizing that they had been attacked. They were bleeding, they were in pain, and they started talking about what had been happening to them. They weren't believed by the elders in the community. They were told, "This is your wild female imagination," and or the work of the devil. You're being punished.
They'd been
for something.
Drugged, hadn't they? They'd been drugged and then raped.
Yeah, there was a spray that that the attackers were using to knock them out, knock the entire family out, go into the house, rape the women and the girls, and some of the boys and men were also assaulted in these communities. Eventually, it was one or two of the women who caught one of the attackers coming in through the window, and then the whole, you know, story came out.
So men were convicted, weren't there? There were.
And men, there were seven or eight men. Right. But they did bring in the police. These are self-police communities. Essentially, what the elders of the community had wanted to do was simply say, okay, simply isolate the men. In fact, they kept them in a kind of shed, hoping that that would solve the problem. But, you know, eventually the police did come. It was investigated. These men were taken to the city, put on trial, convicted, and are still in prison, as far as I know.
Your book is the women talking about what happened, isn't it? It's the most extraordinary story.
So the book is, like I said, you know, an imagined response to these attacks, getting together in a loft, in a barn, hayloft, and to talk about what they're going to do. And they have a, you know, kind of short window where the men are in the city attempting to get the attackers home, get them out on bail, for instance. And so they have a short window and they have to figure out what they're going to do, whether they're going to stay.
Do you have input into the film and how it's written and the script and everything? Will you be on the set?
Sarah Pauly, who wrote the screenplay, she's the director as well. Yeah. And she and I talked a lot. She showed me drafts, and, you know, so I had a little bit of input, and I was on the set. I was able to visit set. I met this incredible cast. Yeah. I met these actors, which was very exciting.
And I think it's due to be out later this year. So whether that's in the US, North America rather, and UK, but we'll keep people posted on that because we're very, very excited about it. Now, we'd love to know a little bit about some of the writers and books that have had the most impact on you throughout your life as well. Mm-hmm. So maybe you might just share a few of those.
They've just been so many, Virginia Woolf, Alice Munro here, and well, my sister was 6 years older than me, and you know, had started university at 18. I was 12, and she had a bookshelf that I was absolutely not supposed to touch or go to, or not even being around. I would, you know, she was off at university, and I would go and go through all these books and the dirty parts and everything. But eventually I would read them all. Joy Williams, Marilyn Robinson, I mean, Ferrante, and, you know, female writers along the way that have had such a powerful effect on me. Natalia Ginsburg, for instance. Just now, actually, I'm reading a book by Celia Paul, British artist, called Letters to Gwen John, who Gwen John has died, of course, but she's writing to these letters to her ostensibly, and talking about the parallels between their lives, you know, being the muses essentially, or the models for these great artists, Rodin and Lucian Freud, and eventually moving out of that to become artists themselves, and solitary artists, you know, and then just that idea of you know, that need for solitude. I guess I'm really feeling that here in my compound with all the
your compound.
It's really people. Yeah, it's really appealing to me on that level. You know? Like, yeah, you know, we can ask for this. We can insist on this. We can, you know, as artists,
in your head.
We can respect this. You know, we need this solitude, this solitary time. And I'm also reading Christian Wiman, an American poet. He just writes so beautifully and about faith and about art and its intersection and about struggle. And it's so inspiring, the futility that we all feel so often, you know, in terms of our art, but also life itself. You know, why are we doing this? What's the point? And I just find it very edifying.
Well, that's a wonderful
Christian Wiman.
Wonderful list for us. And are you writing something at the moment?
Well, I'm trying to, but again, all these people are
it's not possible to write anything with all the people, is it?
It is. And again, you know, I've been doing it for so long that I you know, I can carve out this time in this place and get the writing done. So I'm trying.
Excellent. Well, we can't wait for whatever you have up your sleeve for us next. But thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Oh, it's been fun, and thank you so much for having me.
Oh dear, here we are. The time has arrived for all the M's again: midlife, milestones, and magic moments. I am loving these, I have to say. Yes. I often listen to them a couple of times just to spur me on. Now, this is the part of the show in which one of our listeners calls in to share their short story of a midlife epiphany. This is a little bit of inspiration for you all, we hope, who may need a nudge to change or simply want to hear about how other midlife women are making the most of their wonderful second acts.
And dialing in this week, we have Anise.
Hey, Postcards from Midlife. My name is Anise Eden. I just turned 50 and I live in Ireland. I've had three major midlife milestones. The first was having a hysterectomy after a 30-year battle with endometriosis. I've learned that many women experience feelings of loss with that surgery. I think there's an added dimension to that grief when you're childless like me. I don't believe grief ever really goes away, so for me, it's been a process of learning to live and thrive alongside it and to accept it as part of who I am. My second milestone was becoming an expat at midlife, moving from the US to Ireland to be closer to my husband's family. As a social worker in the US, I had been thinking about getting involved in academia. Much to my delight, after reaching our new home, those doors opened for me. I'm now doing a PhD and lecturing as well. Thanks to this opportunity, I've discovered a passion for teaching that I never knew I had. It's incredibly stimulating and rewarding and so much fun. The third milestone was becoming an author. That was a total surprise and something I'd never dreamed of doing, but I was struck hard by a wave of inspiration and just started writing. I was a bit shocked when my debut novel was picked up by an agent and then a publisher. And then coincidentally, it was released just a few months before my hysterectomy. I've now had 4 books published, and I believe that breathing life into this creative part of myself not only helped me cope with being childless, but also played a big part in a sort of general midlife renaissance. I wanted to share my story with other listeners just to show that even in challenging circumstances, midlife can be a time of self-discovery and exploration, forming new communities, and other exciting changes. I'm really looking forward to what comes next. Thank you so much.
Here we are, Nostalgia Noodle. It's my turn to ask you which year I have taken the TARDIS back to.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay, here we go. It's a year of the dragon, Trish.
That means nothing to me.
Shall I tell you why I'm saying that? I'm trying to make it mathematical because the Chinese calendar goes in 12 years and we're in the year of the tiger. Can you work it out?
Nice chance.
So I'm going to start difficult.
Yeah.
Then I'm going to kind of drop them in because I think you'll get it pretty quickly once I drop one or two of these in. It was the final episode of the Peanuts cartoon.
Oh.
Snoopy.
Right, that's difficult.
Yeah. It was Goblet of Fire. We've been talking about Harry Potter. So that was number 4 in the series. Jennifer Aniston and Brad Pitt got married in this year.
Ooh. Lovely Jennifer and Brad.
How far are you? Are you anywhere near?
I am in around, I'm late 90s or early noughties. Early noughties.
I did it again. Was number 1 for a very long time.
In that case, I'm more mid-90s.
You're getting colder, not warmer here.
So Goblet of Fire book, not Goblet of Fire film?
No, the book.
Oh, fine. Okay, so... Okay.
Okay, come on.
Oh, is that it? Do I have to guess now?
No. All right, then. Bill Gates left Microsoft this year to set up a foundation. No, that's not helping. I can see that's not helping. It's the year I got married, Trish. Does that help you more?
Okay. I think it's going to be 2000.
You got it!
Yay!
I was going to say the world didn't end and the Millennium Dome was built.
Yeah. I didn't need those. I got it. It's a bit like Name That Tune. Do you remember that program?
Yes.
Where you just get ping, I'll name that tune in one. Ping.
That's like the hurdle, which is the musical version of the Wordle, which I can do the hurdle, but I can't do the Wordle. You just get a few beats of the song.
I think I'd be quite good at that.
Yes, I think you would.
Yeah.
It's my copper wedding anniversary this year. 22 years is copper. What do I want for a copper wedding anniversary? What's my present?
I just can't think. Copper piping, copper, I don't know, roof. I don't know.
Could they get a green bath, I think.
Copper bath. That's quite glamorous and sexy for a wedding anniversary present. You're not really getting one of those, are you? No.
Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Postcards from Midlife. New episodes are available to listen to every Sunday on your podcast provider, and we'd really appreciate it if you can make sure to download your episodes so they count on our listener numbers. And if you can rate and review us too, that would be marvellous.
And please tell your friends about us, because we want as many women as possible to join in this midlife conversation, which is what our private Facebook group is all about. So if you're not a member yet, do come over and join in the chat. You just have to answer 3 questions, as is quite standard on private Facebook groups, but please make sure you agree to the rules, because otherwise we can't let you in, and we want to let you in.
No, can't have people in who don't agree to the rules, Trish. No,
exactly. You know, I'm rules and regulations, health and safety.
Also, you can only come in if you send me snacks. You can also use our private Facebook group to post any feedback on the topics we discuss, as well as suggest other things you would like us to talk about, or celebrities and experts you would love to hear interviewed. Or you can email us at hello@postcardsfrommidlife.com. or pop a little message on Instagram too. Goodbye.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.